You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We head to Ohio this week, on the search for some of the Buckeye State's stranger events. Authors Kevin Moore and Christina Smith from the Rutherford B. Hayes Museum join me to cover some of the cases they've covered in their brilliant Unnatural Ohio book. From Ray Shockey's encounter with the Loveland Frogman to two of the most compelling UFO stories in modern history, some Bigfoot talk and a headless motorcyclist, Kevin and Christina's book has it all. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to each and everyone who continues to support the show with their patron contributions. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and merchandise. Our intro and outro music is performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thanks as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Let's join Kevin and Christina then, as we venture out on the search for Unnatural Ohio. In their new book, Christina Smith and Kevin Moore delve into Unnatural Ohio to shed some light on the state's supernatural superstars. Guys, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having us.
You are very welcome. What a lovely book. As we were chatting before I started the interview, I'm always on the lookout for books from all kinds of locations around the world because I love all kinds of strange things. I always consider myself a collector of modern folklore these days, because I think these kind of collections, we've kind of gone from tall tales and strange things to some of these books being quite important, I think, in collating and collecting regional stories such as these. So is that something that you both had a long interest in regards to local weirdness, or have you just liked weirdness in general?
Well, I grew up with this stuff from an early age, and I think Christina has too. I can remember being a youngster and checking out from the library a really popular series of books that came out in the early 90s called Haunted Ohio by Chris Woodyard, where she, you know, told ghost stories from right in our backyard. And that's always fun to read. And when you're, you know, 10, 11, 12, freaking yourself out about them. But of course, you know, I grew up watching X-Files and shows like that, and you know, just getting interested in the weird and paranormal stuff.
Yeah, I would say same. I would watch Unsolved Mysteries, which was a show here in the States that you know, it would be about crime and things, but they would have ghost stories, and you know, Bigfoot might be on, and Loch Ness Monster. And for some reason, I don't know if Loch Ness Monster was on there, but when I was younger, I was really fixated on Loch Ness Monster. And so I spent a lot of time at the public library in my town, and I checked out every book on the Loch Ness Monster. And I was like, I'm going to figure out if this thing is real or not. So, and then there was a series of books, kind of like Kevin was talking about, called, it was something like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yeah.
And so we always went camping, and I would read those when we were camping by the campfire. So, yeah, I guess both of us have always been into the weird and unusual.
I mean, obviously, Christina, you've got a background in as an investigative journalist. I suppose is this something that, as a professional, often we hear people are kind of steered away from that type of thing when they're working in journalism. But I suppose you've probably stumbled across a few strange stories over the years. That is it one of those where you pass it to the junior reporter because nobody wants to go and speak to the old person who's seen Bigfoot?
Oh, that's a great question. So I spent most of my time at smaller newspapers in the chain that owns USA Today. It's called Gannett. And so when you work at a smaller newspaper, you kind of specialize, you don't really specialize. So you might have like three people, and one covers court cases and police, and another one covers city council, and then you do everything in between. So usually if we would get like a weird case like that, they knew I was interested in that, so they would shift it to me. So usually we'd get, you know, sometimes we get some weird history questions and things like that. So yeah, so I don't know. I think it was just mostly people at the paper knew I was super into that. So like, oh, you can talk to this person.
So. Yeah. You didn't have a situation like Linda Godfrey when she was working on her paper where she was the new person and they just went, well, you can find out about the werewolf running about.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, it wasn't a situation like that. Although I would have been like, oh, I want to write about the werewolf.
Absolutely. Kevin, obviously you're in charge of, you're the main curator, I believe, as well. So for you, is this, obviously, because this book's been based on the back of a wonderful series and collection that you did based at the museum, where you've essentially had a sort of a folklore exhibition running for about 18 months. Was that something that you'd planned to do for a while? Or as you were saying about your personal interests, did you think it was once again one of those things where you're not only talking about strange things, but you're celebrating the state and some of its weirder characters?
Yeah, so I'm the curator of artifacts at the Rutherford B. Hayes Museum. And, you know, so that means I get to handle all the stuff, which is a great privilege. But I also get to design all of our exhibits. And most of our exhibits usually deal with something related to the presidency, perhaps the Civil War, something from the 19th century when Rutherford B. Hayes would have been living or would have encountered. But for a long time, you know, people have always asked us around Halloween, you know, you guys need to do some kind of, you know, paranormal programming, ghost walks, ghost tours, which is a pretty common thing for historical sites to do in October. And it's something that we've entertained because it does appeal to a different group of visitor who might not be interested in presidential history. So we kind of mulled this over for a couple of years, and we came up with this idea of, well, what if we focus on some of the state's biggest urban legends that are most popular in Ohio? Hayes was a Buckeye Ohio president, very proud Buckeye man. As he referred to himself. So let's limit ourselves to Ohio. You know, he was interested in culture. He was interested in stories and literature. So we'll kind of approach him from the perspective of, you know, we're not going to prove it. We're not going to disprove it. We're not going to try to tell you that Bigfoot in Southeast Ohio is real. But what we're going to do is we're going to show that this is a legend that does exist in Ohio and that people have believed it for a couple hundred years. So let's talk about that as history. And so we have this exhibit. It opened in February of 2020. It was called Ohio and Unnatural History. And it showcased a number of cryptids, some ghost stories, a couple of UFO sightings. And then we teamed up with a local artist who kind of made illustrations of it for the exhibit. Unfortunately, a couple of weeks into it, COVID happened, so we had to shut down. But we were able to extend the exhibit through Halloween of 2021, and it was very popular. People really enjoyed it, and it definitely appealed to a different demographic that, you know, they came for Bigfoot and the Loveland Frog, but they stayed to take a tour of President Hayes's house, which is great.
Absolutely. Well, I think as well, it's good that you can do that. As someone that loves museums and galleries, as well as the weird, I think anything that can kind of appeal to those people who wouldn't normally come and visit you, as you mentioned there, Kevin, I think can only be a good thing. I mean, it's a win-win, really. You're kind of giving them what they want, but as you say, you're also tantalizing them and saying, well, what about this bit of our history that you might not be aware of? Because obviously, Hayes was quite a forward-thinking man towards the end of the 19th century. He's one of those rare presidents that said he was only going to do one term, which I think a lot of us in the modern era would be hopeful that should be more often, I think, depending on what you may think. No political allegiances regards.
He was hoping that would be a trend and it never really caught on.
Yes. It was a great idea. Unfortunately, nobody seemed to agree with him, sadly, which is always the strange thing. Most people do until they get in and then they go, actually, I think two terms is really good. He is, like I say, he's one of those people I think he gets often overlooked. And I think anything where you can shed a bit more light, because I love history, because even in regards to the weird and the wonderful and the paranormal, I've always said that if nothing else, it gets you to places and takes you to locations that you wouldn't normally go to that are quite historical, because you might want to see the local ghost or you've heard about the UFO sighting there, and then you stay for the history. And I think that anything like that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, you know, it's very doubtful that Hayes himself would have bought into much of this. He tended to be a bit of a skeptic. In fact, there's a quote somewhere in his diary. He founded the Cincinnati Literary Society, and at one of their meetings, this is in probably the 1850s, I think, they had a clairvoyant come by to visit to give a lecture. This was in the burgeoning days of the spiritualist movement, and he complains about, I can't believe we're having this guy come and speak. This is lowering the bar. So he didn't really buy into it, but you know, his lifetime in the late 1800s coincides with the birth of the spiritualist movement, which is popular both here and in the UK. And that era really shapes a lot of what we think of when we think about ghosts and hauntings today.
I mean, that is interesting as well, because it's one of those strange periods, because like you say, after the Fox sisters kind of launched themselves across America and went on tour, you had all kinds of strange characters appear. One of my favorites is the Davenport brothers, who could only contact spirits inside a box. Nobody could see them, but they were extremely popular and went on tour, apart from when they came to Liverpool here, and the residents were not very impressed by their show and smashed their box up and sent them back to America with their tails between their legs.
Oh my.
There's so many weird people in that kind of era, and it's not surprising, because obviously you've got a history of presidential spiritualism as well, going back to sort of Lincoln and his wife moving forwards, and it was obviously getting everywhere, and it was classed as entertainment for high society a lot of the time as well. So it would be no surprise that somebody like Hayes would end up sort of running into some charlatan or two pretending to be able to pass on messages from beyond. So I think that whole period is really interesting, how quickly it spreads all across America. And it's remarkable, really, because when you think about the society at the time and people's religious leanings, it's one of those things when you look back, I still find it quite surprising how quickly it took off. And how quickly it spread, because it seemed to be from Washington State down to Florida within about 20 years and everywhere in between.
Yeah, I think that ties in a lot with the aftermath of the American Civil War. You know, you have tens of thousands of families who've lost loved ones. They've lost sons, brothers, husbands, very suddenly. And, you know, now you have these sisters and then other supposed mediums who say that, you know what, you can talk to them. You can resolve any last business or, you know, farewells. And I think that's really what people kind of latched onto in the 1860s, 70s, 80s. And then, you see a resurgence of it in the US and the UK in the years following World War One. You know, kind of the same idea.
Yes, very much so. It was everywhere here, primarily due to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle being its main proponent in the UK.
Yeah.
And obviously his friendship and fallout with Houdini and all the ramifications of that and the whole fairy scandal and all sorts. But it's once again, Doyle was one of those people, like you say there, Kevin, that he was grief stricken because his son died in the First World War. And obviously very similar to everything that happened in the American Civil War. You can understand a little bit why people wanted a bit of closure, because for a lot of them, they weren't able to visit where their sons and husbands and fathers had passed away, because obviously this was a countrywide conflict. So people from New York State would have their relatives fighting in the lower 48, places like Louisiana and Tennessee, places that they would never ever visit normally. So for them, I suppose it was the easiest way to try and, as you say, make a farewell with them.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for closure, for sure.
So, Christina, obviously, when Kevin's created this wonderful exhibition, and this is kind of one of those fortuitous things, you've obviously been a previously published author with your Lost Sandusky book. And so that kind of, you were on their radar, and clearly they'd heard what a brilliant creation Kevin had come up with, and you'd assisted with him as well. Were you excited to be involved in this with your love of Nessie, or was it something that, even as you were saying about getting those strange reports passed to you as a reporter, where you were like, shall we do this?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I have always wanted to write a book like this, actually. Like when I was a kid and I would read the scary stories to read in the dark, you know, and then I have wherever we've gone. So I have like haunted Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I have haunted Boston. You know, everywhere we go, I have the haunted book. So it was something I always wanted to do, but it just, you know, never really came up. And I'm like, someday I'll pitch a ghost book or something like that. But, you know, there are a lot of ghost books and things out there. So History Press actually approached Kevin. And so to my good fortune, Kevin was like, oh, well, Christina wrote her first book with them. Maybe we could co-write it. So thank you, Kevin. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but no, I was very, very excited about it because I'd always kind of wanted to do something like this, but I wasn't exactly sure how, because like I say, there were a lot of ghost books out there. And so a lot of the material has already been covered. So this project gave us an opportunity to look at these things more in depth and do something a little bit different. So I was super excited. So yeah, so it kind of fulfills a childhood dream, I guess.
What about yourself, Kevin? Obviously, were you excited, humbled, flattered to be asked to create this book?
Oh yeah, I got this email out of the blue. You know, the exhibit was over and it had a great run and we were proud of it and kind of thought, well, that was the end of it. We'll move on to the next thing. And then a few months later, that email comes in from History Press said, you know, we heard about this exhibit. We think it'd be a great opportunity to write a book. Would you be interested in expanding your research? And I was just floored that they wanted to do that. Because it's a lot of fun. I love to write, but also when making an exhibit, you know, when you write about one of these things, nobody has time to stand there for 20 minutes and read your wall paint, right? You have to condense it down to, you know, like 200-300 words and just kind of give the gist of it. This was a good opportunity to really get in, really flesh out these stories and really dive into the research behind them.
I mean, when you obviously based creating the book, going back to the exhibition, did you use every exhibit that you'd had on display, Kevin? Or was it a case of you had certain amount of room in the museum to do such a thing? And therefore, when you came to do the book, did you have a couple of favorite cases that you weren't able to use in the exhibition?
So the book actually kind of expands on the exhibit. So I think there are some things from the exhibit that we didn't put in the book, but there are things in the book that weren't in the exhibit. So it kind of, like Kevin mentioned, I believe this is maybe the only exhibit where I actually got to write two of the panels. And Kevin does this all the time, but I can't tell you how hard it is, like he was saying, to condense it into, you know, something really small. So this was a chance to really expand on things and look into some different stories as well. I guess some of the examples are we have a chapter on Lake Erie legends, like the Black Dog of Lake Erie, the Lake Erie Triangle that were not in the exhibit. And I think I'm missing something.
In the exhibit, we touch on a little bit like the Puckwudgie legend from Native American folklore. And so we didn't put that into the book. That's something that if we were going to flesh it out a little more deeply, I would like to consult with some indigenous scholars or experts before getting too deep into that subject. Another one that didn't make it is there's a reputation of phantom animals that happen in Ohio. Supposedly we have phantom panthers around the Lake Erie area, and there's phantom kangaroos.
Yes.
I don't know why we have kangaroos, but apparently we do. So some of those things didn't quite make the cut.
Yeah, I've heard of the phantom kangaroos. I think Lauren Coleman covered them in Mysterious America many years ago.
Oh, okay.
I think so. Yeah, I've encountered them in a couple of books, and I think Lauren Coleman's is the one.
Yeah, they're probably on holiday from Florida, Kevin. Everything's in Florida, it would seem. And, I mean, here in the UK, we've got a couple of colonies of wallabies that were escaped pets that are still thriving nearly 100 years later. So.
Oh, my goodness.
Who knows? Because I've read a couple of those.
Real ones.
Yeah, not phantom ones. Yeah, we've got phantom black cats, allegedly, but we don't have the kangaroos. We've got the smaller variety, wallabies. But yeah, nothing surprising, especially around Lake Erie. I mean, there's not much that doesn't seem to happen around there.
Yeah, that's true. Lake Erie, you know, it's Erie is a Native American word for Lake of the Cat. So I don't know if that's why there's a lot of black cat sightings, although those are also around the rest of the state as well. But yeah, it does seem like Lake Erie has a little bit of everything. So maybe just because the Great Lakes, you know, even here in the States, a lot of people They think lake and they think, you know, a small lake, like you can see the other side because there are so many of those. So even when I worked at the paper, sometimes there would be a boat rescue on Lake Erie and somebody from one of our offices in the central part of the state would be like, well, can't you just go stand on the shore and take pictures? And we're like, no, this is like a mini ocean. So I think it's got a lot of mystery to it. Maybe that's why.
Yeah. And there are very lots of ghost legend. And you covered the ghost legends, but the Great Lakes are incredibly treacherous and dangerous. You know, for example, my dad has a sailboat, sails around Lake Erie. And, you know, now he's retired. He's moved to Florida. And he talks to people down there who have boats and they sail around the Gulf of Mexico. And he tells me, yeah, I got a sailboat up in Lake Erie. And they go, you are nuts. You couldn't pay me to sail up there because you can be on the lake and you get a notification that says storm's coming, get off the lake. You're going to have 6-foot waves in 20 minutes. And it's pretty treacherous. There's lots of shipwrecks and things like that.
I believe Erie has the most shipwrecks of all the Great Lakes. If not the most, it's close. There's actually a map of them that you can see, and lots of people dive on them. So there, I feel like the lake has a lot of mystery to it because of those things.
Yeah. I find it odd that people see, even in the modern era, seem to think that they're, like you say, they're like our lakes, whereas they are essentially, all of them are inland seas, aren't they? They're enormous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so many stories across all of them, mysterious disappearing ships just vanishing in the blink of an eye, and strange plane crashes and lights seen above them and all sorts. So,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, as you come to pull the book together, then as we talk, we're literally just following on from one of your newer cryptid conferences that seems to have become quite famous, which, as I was saying before we started, is based on one of my very favorite strange cryptid stories, because I like the little weird ones that are just seem to be a one-off, like things like the Jersey Devil and the Night Striders and things that don't often come across. We, you know, there are lots of stories about Dogman and Bigfoot and mysterious black dogs and things, but Ohio is home to the Loveland Frogman, which is one of those wonderful stories because it's a very odd creature anyway, but also the fact that it was the police that were involved.
Yeah. So like you said, we just came back from the second annual Loveland Frog Festival that was put on in Loveland, which is a little suburb town just north of Cincinnati. And shout out to Jeff Craig, who creates the Hidden Ohio map. He's a cartographer and he's made a paranormal atlas travel map of Ohio. So if you're interested in driving around and checking out haunted sites, you can pull out the map and go find them. But he organized the conference and it was a great festival. But yeah, Loveland Frog is really interesting because, like you said, it's not like Bigfoot, where you can go just about anywhere in North America and you can find Bigfoot sightings. And also, it's not like a creature that supposedly inhabits this small area, but it keeps getting seen again and again and again. It really only showed up supposedly once or twice. So it's a pretty kind of an isolated incident, but you get this whole legend that's kind of grown up around it. And I really like the way that Loveland in the last couple decades has really embraced this frog creature as part of their heritage and culture. I think it's really cool. And I think Lovelanders, you know, are kind of proud of the fact that they have this this creature. Back in 1972, there were a pair of police officers, Loveland police officers. This was in early March. They were driving around on their patrol. One guy's name is Ray Shockey. The other one is Mark Matthews. And supposedly they... Ray Shockey first, on his own, he saw this, what he described as a giant frog. It was kind of by the Little Miami River, which goes through Loveland. And he stopped and saw it in his headlights, didn't really know what it was. It's this very large thing kind of crouched on the side of the road. And it apparently stands up on two legs and walks away. And it terrified him. He kind of kept it close. He didn't say, you know, didn't say too much about it, but he ended up telling it to his partner, Mark Matthews. And a couple weeks later, later in March, they ended up seeing it again. And they did end up filing a report about it. The police chief got involved. They contacted the local zoo in Cincinnati to try to get a naturalist perspective on what could this have been. Are there any creatures that match this description. And as you can imagine, no, they're not. The news media got a hold of this. And what's cool is you can go back and you can look at some of the newspaper reporting from the time. And the press kind of makes fun of them a little bit about this. There's a really interesting kind of political cartoon or illustration of a policeman. He's got his pistol out, pointing at the frog, and the frog will boggle your mind. And they, you know, definitely ridiculed them. And the two guys tried to kind of not, they quit giving interviews after a while. And my understanding is that the one officer, Ray Shockey, doesn't really talk about it, didn't talk about it then for the decades since. The other guy, Mark Matthews, has come out periodically and said things about it. It's a little unclear exactly what happened, like when did they see it. Mark Matthews says he shot at it. Depending at what point and what reporter he's talking to, sometimes he says it was aggressive towards him, so he shot it. Another time he says he shot it just because it was weird. Once he says he shot and missed it and got away. He shot and hit it. It limped off and got away. At one point, he even said he shot it, hit it, threw it in the trunk of his car so he could show Ray Shockey what it was, and it was just a big iguana. Like an escape pet, like your wallabies. That does have some issues. Ohio in March is not reptile weather, no. Right? Most of our reptiles probably go in the hibernation at the time of the year, right?
Yeah. You wouldn't see frogs popping
frogs,
out.
Frogs, turtles.
Yeah, all that stuff.
So there's some questions about that. But yeah, that's the interesting case. And there's some other stuff that's kind of been attached to it over the decades. But yeah, it's a really interesting, weird story.
Mm. I suppose, Kevin, this is probably your first introduction to this other phenomenon that seems to occur around these cases, which is the implausible explanation. As you say there, even the most basic of animal lover will be able to tell you the difference between a frog and an iguana. And I would suspect, as you very kindly pointed out there, Ohio is not a place for humans, I would imagine, at the best time and the coldest days in winter. never mind some lizards. And as far as most people are aware, iguanas obviously can't stand up, but then again, neither can frogs. So when you're sort of dealing with these cases, as you both started to look into them, and obviously one of the other cases has got another of my least favorite skeptical explanations about anything seen in the sky, how did that strike you? Because like you say, when you start looking at some of these stories, the explanations or the reasons given for what Ray Shockey saw, that doesn't make much sense either.
They don't. They're, you know, I think there's a human need to want to explain.
Yes.
When you see something strange and unexplainable. Now, that's not to say necessarily that they did see a bipedal frog. Maybe they did.
Yeah.
But a lot of times those explanations fall way short of what the person is describing.
Hmm.
Right. The iguana. I mean, I've seen iguanas, gone on a cruise, been to Mexico. I've seen the big iguanas. They're still, one, they can't stand up. And two, they're still not that big, even if they are really big. So, you know, I'm at a loss to figure out how he would have shot something like that. You know, that's a heck of a shot if you really think about it. So a lot of times those types of explanations where skeptics are kind of very quick to just, this is what it is, let's move on. A lot of times they fall short. And I think that's very frustrating for people who either do believe in the paranormal or have experienced something personally. And a lot of times they feel like they're not being listened to or they're feeling ridiculed. And that's a theme that I think we discovered again and again in these stories, tracing the people who had these experiences through newspapers and documents and interviews, that a lot of times they just want to be taken seriously and be taken, you know, be heard. And unfortunately, a lot of times the lesson they learn is just shut up and keep quiet.
I know that you've said in a couple of interviews that when you were pulling this book together, you were very careful not to sort of fall into that comedy, jokey kind of style and try and treat these stories with a bit more respect than you've probably seen them discussed previously. And I think, as you refer to there, for a lot of people, there is this initial period where they may get interviewed about any kind of phenomenon. And then it's the response afterwards and newspaper reports and people pointing and laughing at them that can, they tend to just sort of shrink away from that. And That would seem to be a constant, regardless of whether you're talking about people that have seen monsters or strange lights in the sky or ghosts even, that people will tell certain people and then a story will get out and then they just don't want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah, that seems to occur again and again. And, you know, there's people that I know personally, they're very intelligent. I respect their opinion. And, you know, they're obviously very sane, rational people. And I've had a couple of them, you know, when they heard we were doing this exhibit or that we were writing this book, you know, they wait till everybody's gone. Let me tell you what happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, and they tell you this, you know, I'm thinking of one individual specifically that told me this very strange story about an apartment she lived into one time where she saw what would be described as poltergeist activity. Mm. You know, things flying off the floor, getting thrown around the house. And she said that we moved out of that apartment. I have no reason to doubt this person whatsoever. We refer to ourselves as a Mulder and Scully type relationship here, where Christina's a little bit more Mulder and I'm a little bit more Scully.
Yeah.
But when I hear people, like trusted people, give me stories like that, I can't discount that. And it would be disrespectful to say, they're just crazy. Cause I know they're not.
Also, you know, a lot of these people have more to lose than to gain by sharing these stories. And I think part of why I think one of our favorite things about all the talks and stuff we do is at the end, people do come up to us. Some of them are happy to share their story in front of everybody, and others, like Kevin said, come up and say, okay, let me tell you what happened. But I think they feel comfortable because they know that we're not going to immediately dismiss them. But a lot of these people, you know, depending what they do for a living or things like that, sharing the story, you know, they would have more to lose than to gain. So you have to wonder why they would make it up. And I think, you know, we're not saying, oh, yes, they did for sure see a ghost or things like that. But we're not discounting it either, because clearly, you know, they saw something they can't explain. You know, maybe there is a perfectly logical explanation for it, and maybe there isn't.
I think that's always interesting as well, because that's something I've discovered since doing the show. I was always that strange person that would, you know, if we were out anywhere or did anything, I'd always end up saying to him, have you seen a ghost? Have you experienced anything strange? And like you say, I think sometimes you've got the two types of people. You've got the people who wait till everybody's gone, who say, can I tell you about the strange thing that happened to me? Or you'll get the other people that just stand up in the middle of a crowd and go, right, I'm going to tell you about the time I met Bigfoot. And they just don't care. And it's interesting for me, like you both say there, that you've got these two types of personality, that it's almost as if the people that say it quietly, even though they know other people talk about it quite openly, for them, do you think it goes against everything that they know or they believe they know, and therefore for them, it's very difficult to talk about because as far as their brain tells them, it should never have happened?
Yeah, I think, for example, at Frogman Festival, a gentleman came up to our table and talked to us about some things that he had seen in the Dayton area. And he talked to us quite a while about his, he didn't see Frogman, but kind of a Bigfoot type creature. He talked to us for a while about it. And it's very clear that he saw something, he doesn't know what it is, and it bothers him. He's very unsettled by the fact that he can't resolve what it is. And so he's telling us about his research. He's trying to find other people that have seen similar things and tracking reports. And so he's very unnerved by that, and he's trying to find an answer. And I think a lot of people are like that. Me, just maybe 2-3 weeks ago, I was taking my garbage out, and I saw a strange light in the sky. And I do some amateur astronomy. I know what's up there. It was a very good day for looking in the sky. But I saw something that was very strange. It was like a star with a kind of a glowy around it. I watched it for a while. The glow moved around. I'm looking up aircrafts on the aircraft tracking app. I'm trying to figure out what it is. And for about 2 hours, I was bothered by this. This shouldn't be here. I've never seen anything like it. Well, it turns out it was actually a SpaceX rocket doing a retro burn. It took about 2 hours to figure it out.
Yeah.
But it looks really weird when they crash the rocket into the ocean. And everybody on the East Coast could actually see it. It was descending into the Atlantic. And I could see it from here in Ohio. But, you know, for that couple hours, I got that little taste of, I just saw something really weird and I don't know what it is. And it's very unsettling.
Yeah, and I think that that gentleman who came up to us too, you know, he was asking, do you guys know of any of these Bigfoot-like creatures? Do you? And I think maybe he talked to some other people too, but I think at events like that, you feel kind of safe maybe sharing your story and seeing if anybody knows. But yeah, I think it is human nature to be like, what was that? And try to figure it out.
And I will add, you know, it's a much, you said safe, safer time now here in the 2020s. Than it would have been in the 1970s or 1960s. Mm-hmm. People were not as accepting of the paranormal or as accepting of people who believed in the paranormal, right? There was very rigid, you know, what is socially acceptable to talk about, right? Mm-hmm. So you got to keep that in mind, too. It's much easier for people to share stories like that today than it would have been years ago.
Yeah.
So how did you find your having your stall at the festival then? Was it exciting for you both as published authors with this wonderful book, as well as being able to indulge in talking to other people with strange experiences, or were you surprised how many people came and shared stories with you?
Yeah, so at this point we kind of expect people to come share stories, but I think that that gentleman was the first one who had come to us with that specific type of story about a Bigfoot like creature. But I think it just, that was the first festival like that that we had been to. And there were I know they had at least 700 pre-sale tickets. So it was huge. So it was just really nice to have all these people come up to us and not only ask about the stories, but I think ask about the research behind them and the documentation of them. And I think that kind of lent to, again, people trying to figure out what these things are. So it was really exciting to kind of be with that group of people and hear their stories and just their excitement for maybe, like you said, all things weird and unusual. So
yeah, because the convention, I mean, it's super fun. It's like going to a Comic-Con almost. People are dressed up in cosplay, and you know, there's vendors selling their Mothman t-shirts and what have you, but you see this I don't know, appreciation of this subculture, and it's cool to see.
Yeah,
I suppose as well, with the chapter you've done on cryptids, obviously we can't really not talk about Bigfoot, as we've mentioned him a couple of times. I suppose one of the things, as a lover of all kinds of hairy hominids from around the world, were you surprised that there is this official, shall we say, rule that before 1958 nobody saw anything running about, and yet obviously in your particular chapter and speaking with another mutual friend, Micah Hanks, the number of stories, if you can be bothered to go back and start researching properly, you suddenly find hundreds of stories of people in the 1850s, 60s, early 19th century, early 20th century, where people are meeting strange hairy creatures. And obviously, one of the running jokes in the world of cryptozoology is how many circus crashes can you have in one country for these monkeys to be on the loose everywhere. Were you surprised looking backwards to see how far back these stories go? Because I know Micah mentions that whilst people try and dismiss it as a modern hoax, the body of evidence far surpasses the late 50s explosion in North American Bigfoot knowledge, really.
It does. There's a wonderful book that we use for research in this book. It's called, I believe it's called The Historical Bigfoot by Chad Arment.
And yes,
he actually, you've probably seen it, he compiles those sightings by state in newspaper articles before Bigfoot came into the lexicon, you know. And so back then they would refer to them as wild men, or like you said, there were lots and lots of instances where somebody said, oh, a gorilla or an ape escaped from the zoo. Well, maybe zoos had terrible enclosures back then, but I kind of doubt it. So, and what's interesting about that is I know in that book, you know, some of those people, they did actually have wild men who sort of what we would call today lived off the grid, and they were hairy and lived in the woods. But if you look at some of those, the descriptions are the same, and they do really match what you started to see in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and up through today of historical Bigfoot sightings. So I wasn't really surprised, but also I grew up in the northwest corner of the state, which had what we called the Great Black Swamp. And it just used to be this impassable mass, and then it was drained for farmland. There's still some remnants of it around today. But growing up, you would hear these stories about, oh, there were reports of these Bigfoot-like creatures in the Great Black Swamp. Now, that's not in our book because I couldn't verify that. So it kind of didn't surprise me just because it's something, you know, Bigfoot is probably one of the most popular cryptids, and you hear so many of these stories. So I guess I wasn't surprised that there were so many going back. I was almost more surprised that some of this folklore I couldn't find documentation for. So that makes me think that possibly there were Bigfoot sightings before that, but again, we could not verify or document that. So that's why that part isn't in the book.
What about you, Kevin, then? Were you team Bigfoot or team misidentified black bear?
So Christina wrote the Bigfoot chapter, and so she knows the research very well. But, you know, looking at some of the newspaper reports that she was able to find and some of the evidence, I mean, the people, the pioneers that settled here, you know, they all had to be avid hunters. They knew what was out in the woods. Mm-hmm. They know the difference between a bear and a person. You know, what is 1869, the first in where
yes.
the Bigfoot
yeah.
attacks a carriage?
Yes, it attacks a carriage over in southeast Ohio.
Right. Yeah. That would have been described as a bear attack. You know, it mm-hmm. had it been a bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So once again, we're at the point where we're applying very mundane explanations, but they don't fit what people are saying, yeah. right?
Exactly. I mean, if you're going to describe an attack like that, you would say we've been attacked by a bear. You wouldn't say we've been attacked by some other, because at the end of the day, a bear's a damn scary creature to come at you. Nobody wants to meet an angry grizzly at the best of times. So why would you pretend it was something else?
Right, exactly. And I think, too, like maybe some of these sightings, I've only seen a bear in the wild once up in the UP, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And sometimes bears, I guess they do walk on 2 feet. But, you know, so it's possible some of these sightings they're seeing the back of it and they think, oh, that's a Bigfoot. But I do think it would be really hard to mistake. I mean, a bear's head is nothing like a giant humanoid or a giant gorilla's head, you know, so. Some of them might be bear sightings, but it's hard to believe that all of them are.
And one thing I did find that was really interesting is you see a transition in the reporting from in the early days, it's wild man, because clearly they're seeing it as a humanoid creature. But when you get to the early 20th century, you see a lot of times them referring to it as an ape or ape-like. And what's interesting is now the people seeing it know what apes are, right? They've mm-hmm. had that exposure and they've seen them in zoos. Mm-hmm. So now they have a new frame of reference to more accurately describe what they're seeing or what it looks like to them. So I just found that interesting that their reference for what they're seeing is changing based on what they're aware of.
Sure.
But you know, you notice bear isn't on the list.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think one of the other aspects of all this that a lot of people don't really contemplate, I think, because we're so used to all of us being able to read or have access to education, is that some of these early pioneer stories are dismissed as, oh, well, they've read about gorillas or apes in the newspaper. And you think, well, how many people could actually read in those days?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's a fair point.
And did they even, you know, especially in the pioneer days, you know, it's not like they would have a newspaper on their front porch every day. So how often did they even get those things, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose, were you surprised then to stumble across a dogman story from Ohio? Because obviously there are other states that would claim to be the dogman capital of the northern U.S.
Sure. We actually, even when I manage our social media here at the museum, and when the exhibit came out, we had somebody say, well, I don't know why you would include Dog Man. That's not an Ohio thing. That's a Michigan thing and a Wisconsin thing. But I guess I should say, yes, I was kind of surprised. So I'm from Defiance, where the Dog Man is. And I had never heard the story. I actually learned about it long before the exhibit from another coworker here who went to the Dog Man Symposium, which is kind of like a festival for Dog Man. It only happened the one time, but I guess they're talking about having another one. So that'll be exciting. But having grown up there, I was like, I don't know anything about this Defiance werewolf, because you also hear it called the Defiance werewolf. So I immediately texted both my parents, and my dad, of course, remembered it. He never saw it. but my mom didn't. And so what's interesting about that Dogman case is it really is unique compared to the Michigan and Wisconsin, because this particular Dogman, well, first of all, a lot of people in Defiance didn't remember it. It sort of had a resurgence over the years. But our friend here who we work with actually ran a paranormal radio show, and he had been looking for years for somebody from Defiance who remembered it to interview. So he was thrilled when we finally found, when I said, oh, my dad remembers it. And he's like, no one remembers it. So it's unusual, but it's very well documented. Two newspapers covered it, including the Toledo Blade, which is a bigger newspaper, and as well as the local paper, which is called the Defiance Crescent News. But the Dogman actually wore blue jeans. Yes. And as far as I know, that's the only sighting of a Dogman with blue jeans. He had a stick or a 2x4 that he held in a menacing way. So that's a little bit unusual. And it happened in this neighborhood in Defiance is very interesting. It's just a couple blocks from downtown, and it's industrial, but yet there are also houses there. So it happened in a sort of more urban slash industrial slash populous area, as opposed to, you know, the Michigan sightings and the Wisconsin sightings are more out in the middle of nowhere. So by the time we got to the book, I wasn't surprised, but I will say when I first found out about it, the first thing I said is, well, I'm from Defiance and I've never heard of this. What are you talking about? So I immediately started digging into it. Of course, my dad emailed me all these articles and all kinds of stuff like that. So that's one of my favorite stories in the book.
I'm really, the thing that strikes me about that particular cryptid is that you had about 2 weeks of what you call werewolf hysteria.
Yes. Yeah.
And nobody remembers it.
Yeah, it just went away.
You would think that's something, you know, hey, you guys remember that time that, I mean, it's not as grand of a scale, but it would be like, remember when we all were in quarantine for several months?
Right.
And people saying, no, I don't remember that. You would think this would make some kind of a bit of a mark in your memory, but it did.
But yeah, they kind of forgot. Now, with that Dogman Symposium and then more being done on Dogman, he's kind of having a resurgence. So you're finding more people, like if you look on social media, who do remember it. But before all this happened, it just kind of faded away. You know, it's not like in Loveland where they kind of celebrate the Frogman, or, you know, in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where they celebrate Mothman. Dogman just kind of got forgotten.
Yeah, it's a weird cultural phenomenon that as well, I think, because you see that happen in certain other cases around the US. And yet other places, as you mentioned, like Loveland, Van Meter, there are certain little towns where they've fallen in love with their cryptid because, with the greatest of respect, nobody's coming to there unless there's a monster to find out about. And it seems to be this new kind of social upheaval that people are utilizing their folklore and their history, even if they're about really strange things, as a way to actually celebrate and keep their small towns alive. Because I'd never have heard of Van Meter if it wasn't for this giant winged creature that terrorized people 100 years ago, you know? And it's the same with Loveland. I'd have never heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Same. Or Kevin often says with Point Pleasant, with Mothman.
Yeah, I mean, most people, they have no reason to go to Point Pleasant. Industry has left. It's unfortunately a, you know, sad victim of the Rust Belt, mm-hmm. which affects, you know, all the Great Lakes region. But Point Pleasant, I would say, is the textbook of how a town can really leverage its paranormal heritage. And then you get people from all over the country who go there almost on like a pilgrimage to visit. Whereas otherwise, I mean, aside from that, there's really nothing there.
It is. It's remarkable that it, as you say, Point Pleasant is known around the world primarily because of the work of John Keel and Mothman,
mm-hmm.
and that incredible statue with the buns of steel.
I heard it, that one of the speakers this weekend called it the shiny hiney.
Yeah, I did an episode recently with Steve Ward, who works at the Mothman Museum in Point Pleasant. So yeah, he's one of those people, what he doesn't know about Mothman isn't worth knowing.
Very good. Yeah, I've been to the museum.
I have not been to the museum actually. Kevin wrote the Mothman chapter.
But yeah, it's a really cool site. It's super fun.
Yeah, it's been on my bucket list for a while. If I survive looking for Sasquatch in British Columbia, then Point Pleasant is next. One of the other great things about this book is it touches on two of my very favourite UFO encounters, not just from Ohio, because there are two brilliant cases that you mention. One is, once again, dismissed as a police officer who's an idiot and chases Venus, which is one of those things, I suppose, when you deal with UFO cases, it becomes that thing that we laugh about it now. It's one of those cliches that the amount of people who seem to have been terrified by the planet Venus is remarkable, really. That in itself should be a phenomenon, should it not?
Yeah. So the Portage County UFO chase, this was my favorite one to research and write. And again, largely because it's a very human story. It's about, you know, the people that saw it and what happened to them afterwards. But you're right. This is perhaps the most egregious of ridiculous so-called rational explanations. Right. So this one, and I guarantee that many of your listeners have seen an homage to this, even if they may not be aware of it. So in 1966, in April, a couple police officers in a town called Randolph, Portage County is a little bit east of Akron, and then Akron is south of Cleveland, give you an idea. So it's almost the very eastern edge of the state. They heard some radio chatter about people saying they were seeing a strange object in the sky, and they kind of laughed it off. Everybody on the dispatch were kind of joking about it. And these two police officers, Dale Spar and Wilbur Neff, they are doing their patrol it's just before sunrise, and they see this abandoned car, and so they get out to check it out, and there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with the car, but out of the woods nearby, this object rises out of the woods and kind of hovers over them, and they go and shelter in place in their car. And they radio dispatch, what do we do? The people at the station are making fun of them and says, you know, why don't you take out your pistol and take a shot at it? And they're like, I don't want to do that. But they're actually afraid of it. And so eventually the thing just kind of starts drifting eastward. So they decide to follow it, and it goes faster. They go faster. It goes faster. They go faster. Next thing they know, they're going 80, 90 mile an hour chasing this thing through eastern Ohio. As they get towards the Ohio-Pennsylvania border, there's another police officer from East Palestine, Ohio, which unfortunately of late has become infamous for its train derailment last year.
Oh yeah.
But a patrolman from East Palestine hears about all this and hears on the radio that it's coming this way and watches the object go by. Cop the car goes by, so he pulls in pursuit and goes with them. They go into Pennsylvania. Their station is saying, you don't have jurisdiction in Pennsylvania. You need to come home. but they keep going. They end up almost running out of gas. So they pull into a gas station where they find a Pennsylvania police officer from Conway, Pennsylvania, is there watching the whole thing unfold. And they watch this thing just go straight up. Somewhere around the what would today be the Pittsburgh International Airport. And that's a really interesting case. You've got, you know, a bunch of people on the ground that saw it. You got these police officers that chased the thing. You know, they said when they would kind of go one way, they'd have to kind of stop and back up and kind of keep up with it. And they said the thing would stop and wait for them. It would move at different heights. Very interesting case. But what happens afterwards is almost more interesting than the case itself, because you know, newspapers get a hold of this. It's international news. Newspapers are reporting it internationally. But then the government gets involved. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Project Blue Book, does a very simple investigation, i.e. they made a couple phone calls, and they kind of conclude, and it's just a satellite. And they publish this in the newspaper, and they basically say that these policemen, they initially saw a satellite descending in the sky. The satellite's path kind of got near the planet Venus, and then these police officers then chased the planet Venus into Pennsylvania, which is, you know, not only ridiculous, but it's also insulting. The local people in Portage County that saw it were very offended. The police officers were offended by this. They wrote their local congressman. He got involved. He personally went to the Pentagon to talk to Defense Secretary McNamara to get Project Blue Book to get somebody on the ground. And they ended up, Blue Book still ended up doing a very, very limited investigation. The guy that was in charge of Project Blue Book, Hector Quintanilla, he was not a believer. He wasn't happy that he had ended up on UFO duty as part of the Air Force. He tried to dismiss these things. But really, this whole experience, it wrecked these officers' lives, particularly Dale Spar. He lost his job. His wife divorced him.
Yeah.
He ended up living up out of hotels. Reporters would catch up with him periodically every so many years. One of the officers, he changed his name. He moved across the country. One police officer, he stayed with the department, but when everybody would ask him, he'd say, "I'm not saying a word about that." Mm. And they made illustrations of what they saw, and it's not a big dot of light like what Venus is. They said it was the size of a house. And so the thing that struck me with this case is just how the negative attention affected them, and they were kind of quieted or silenced into staying quiet. And I mentioned in the beginning, everybody listening or many people listening have probably seen this portrayed in popular culture, even though they're not aware of it. So J. Allen Hynek, the famous Project Blue Book consultant turned ufologist later in life, he identifies this case as the number one case that illustrates the government's approach to investigating UFOs. And he also identifies it as the number one case on how experiencers are made to be victims. And he consulted with Steven Spielberg when he was making Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And so if you've ever seen that movie, and there's that scene where all these cop cars are chasing these UFOs down the Indiana Turnpike, and then they kind of just shoot off and the cop cars go off a berm, he encouraged Spielberg to include that scene as an homage to this famous case in Ohio. And so I think that's a great example of how culture preserves this story, even though a lot of people might not be aware of it.
Do you think that the ramifications of what happened in 66 then led into what happened in 73 with the coin incident? Because I've heard him interviewed, and he seems to be quite switched on about things, because he went straight to the press and went, right, this is what we've seen. It's not a satellite. It's not a planet. It was an object in the sky that was keeping pace with me, and I know what I saw. And the authorities were fuming. They couldn't believe it.
Yeah, with that case, I know at the time when the helicopter, so there were four military guys in the helicopter, and when they landed, Coyne tried to report it to somebody, and there was really no agency to report it to. So that's part of why he went to the press. He had, I believe it was his cousin, worked for the plane dealer, and that's kind of how that came about. But I think in that one, because all four of them had basically the same story, of course it differed slightly, but basically they all said the same thing, and they had these backgrounds that qualified them as really credible individuals, it was really hard to discredit them. Not that the police officers in the Portage UFO chase weren't credible, but like you mentioned a few years later, how often are people going to attack the witnesses? And then if you're looking at four military guys, one of them was a detective with Cleveland Police, one of them was a Vietnam veteran. I mean, they all had these impeccable backgrounds and things. It was going to be kind of hard to again say, oh well, Venus was chasing your helicopter, or so you almost crashed your helicopter into Venus. So, and I think that's the difference too. They were actually up in the air when this happened. And the same thing. What could they possibly have to gain by making that up? And in fact too, there was some evidence of it. That when the helicopter, so when this object came at the helicopter, it rose several hundred feet and the compass stopped working, and the compass never worked again. They tried to fix it. They tried to reinstall it. So there was some indication that something happened. I mean, they might just say, oh, the compass just broke, but that's kind of unusual. I do think there are only so many times you can tell people, oh, you saw Venus. Oh, it was swamp gas. I think that's another joke about a lot from Men in Black, and in that case, because there were so many of them, and Lawrence Coyne, he did try to report it to proper authorities first, but there wasn't anybody to report it to. And so he felt like people should know. So he went ahead and went to the press. So. And then the Center for UFO Studies also became involved and did some investigating as well. Of course, J. Allen Hynek went on to found the Center for UFO Studies, and he was one of the people. Jenny Ziedman is the one who did most of the interviews with Coyne and his fellow officers for the Center for UFO Studies, but J. Allen Hynek was involved with that. So I think that's interesting too. You have somebody who went from Blue Book who founded their own agency. So you can kind of see this evolution of investigating these types of incidents.
Yeah. And 1966 seems to be the year that broke Hynek, because as you say, you've got this report with the police. And then also, I think in Michigan, you had the infamous swamp gas explanation, which is what finished him off. Mm-hmm. And like you say, from 7 years to go from being the official debunker to then becoming one of the main leading lights in 1970s ufology is quite a turnaround. So you just wonder how much pressure Hynek had been put up to explain away things that he knew simply couldn't be explained with these silly implausible explanations that the government were putting forward.
Yeah, there's a really good biography on Hynek called the author's name unfortunately escapes me, but it's called The Close Encounters Man. About him and his life. And I think the mid 1960s, 66 specifically, was a turning point, because he'd been consulting for a number of years, and increasingly he was being asked to put his credentials behind statements that he couldn't support scientifically. Mm. And he wasn't being asked to do a actual scientific analysis. He was basically being just asked, rubber stamp this, and it doesn't have to make sense. Just get these reports off our desk.
Yeah.
And he finally had it.
How did you both approach this? Were you interested in UFOs? Because I think it's a different thing going from talking about monsters and ghosts to UFOs, especially in the modern era, because this is probably, as we were saying about how people are open in the modern era, people seem to be happier to share things because they know there's a bigger community. There's a lot more support out there online and at festivals and things like that. Ufology has probably been not taken as seriously probably since the 1950s. Were you surprised, obviously, because of how long it is since you started the exhibit to the book coming out and everything that's gone on afterwards? Does it surprise you both that it seems to be finally being treated seriously?
I would say that a lot has happened in the world of ufology since we started this. Obviously, there was some famous reporting by the New York Times in 2017. Which kind of put on the public's radar that the military is evidently aware of something strange around U.S. training and testing areas. And in the years since, we've seen some kind of loose acknowledgments by the Pentagon. We've seen congressional hearings. We've seen UFO offices open. Arrow, the all domain anomaly resolution office, tasked with researching these things and creating public reports. And a lot of it is very reminiscent of the Blue Book era. So it is kind of interesting that you have seen this kind of explosion in the last maybe 5 years, since we did the exhibit and then started the book. It's kind of a hard question because we have the monsters and the ghosts, which you can kind of clearly put in the legend or folklore category. UFOs are a little different in that they're, many of them, or at least the stories we cover, are much more recent.
Yeah.
Maybe I would say that, if Ohio didn't have some of the best documented UFO cases in the country, we might not include them. But I think there's a lot of legendary elements that have kind of grown up around these stories too, around ufology and about, what a UFO is supposed to look like. How is it supposed to behave? What are aliens supposed to look like? And if you look at the history of ufology, those questions change over time, right? Nobody's really talking about seeing the grays in the early, 1940s, 1950s, right? Mm-hmm. You see these very human looking Nordic occupants, right? So there's some, I think there's a little bit of folkloric element in there, and you can kind of see an evolution going on, which I think lets it qualify for a book like this.
So what about yourself, Christina? Sorry.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. So Yeah, so I've always also been interested in UFOs. I think that one of the things that struck me most about doing the research for this is I interviewed Dr. Roediger from the Center for UFO Studies. He's the current head of it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he said is, you know, people will look back on these times in history and the fact that, and he said this before some of these recent developments, like the reports and hearings before Congress, people will look back at this time in history and it will be seen as how could we possibly ignore these things and not just dismiss them as, oh, people are crazy seeing lights in the sky. You know, we had the big big controversy with the Chinese spy balloon, and we know that wasn't the first one. So even if UFOs are not, you know, aliens or things like that, they're still worth investigating. So I thought that was kind of interesting, sort of throwing in that national security perspective to it. One of the things that's fascinated me is that this is several years ago, but I know the Pope has kind of come out and said that yes, we're probably not alone in the universe. And so I thought that was very interesting. So I do think there is kind of a shift in how we look at these things. And no matter what you think about them, I guess for me personally, just speaking for myself, if there was some strange light in the sky, knowing everything we know about national security today, it would surprise me that we wouldn't try to figure out what it is, or these things that the Navy pilots have been seeing, you know, what are they? I'm not saying that they're aliens. I mean, we don't know what they are. So I think maybe just because, you know, today it's much harder to hide things too than it was back in the 50s. You know, we have the 24-hour news cycle. Everybody has a video camera in their pocket pretty much. So I think the attitude is changing, and it's kind of getting to the point where, yeah, we need to acknowledge these things, and saying it's swamp gas or what have you just isn't going to cut it. So, and we live in a scary world. You know, there's multiple wars going on and things like that. There was the Chinese spy balloon. So I think that the attitude toward maybe figuring out what these things are is changing a little bit. And maybe that's why we're starting to see this resurgence of sort of the Project Blue Book type stuff.
Yeah, and one thing that makes your chapter in the Coin UFO very relevant is one of the panelists at the congressional hearing last summer, his name's Ryan Graves. You know, his whole angle in that hearing was pilot safety.
Yes.
And reporting. And his case was simply, look, I'm not saying aliens, but we're seeing things, we're encountering things. It is a safety issue. And there's nobody I can talk to about it. Mm-hmm. There's no mechanism, there's no procedure. And that's all we want as aviators, right? And I think the guys from the Coin incident 50 mm-hmm. years ago, same thing.
Yeah. What is that? I mean, it almost ran right into their helicopter and killed them. So, you know, to me, it seems like whether you think it's little green men or the grays, or what, I know people don't really say the grays anymore, from another planet visiting, or, you know, who knows what it could be, but it's definitely worth looking into, and it seems silly to ignore it.
Yeah. I know Leslie Keen, she's been a big proponent of that reason for investigating. There is, if nothing else, this is a safety issue, because people are seeing all sorts of things up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even, for example, the Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, who I think is quite skeptical of aliens and very vocally skeptical of aliens being the explanation. Even he concedes, look, I'm a taxpayer, we're paying multiple billions of dollars for defense. If we're seeing weird things in the sky, go figure out what it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I can't let you go without touching on one final story. And we've not mentioned ghosts at all. And so I'm always delighted to stumble across a ghost story I've never heard, especially one as unique as this, because we often hear stories here in the UK of headless horsemen wandering around lonely lanes, terrifying people. But this is the first time I've ever heard of a headless motorcyclist. And this seems a very... There's a lot of similarities with some other stories from the US that seem to be really difficult to pin down where it starts from until it gets popular. And then is it one of those situations like Bloody Mary that it became a campfire tale that's taken on a life of its own? Or, as with this, everybody thought it was just a tall tale until somebody seemed to have had a very frightening encounter.
Yeah, the headless motorcyclist is a great local story that, you know, from our area in Northwest Ohio. Like I mentioned, the Haunted Ohio books I grew up reading. You know, that was my favorite one, The Headless Motorcyclist, because it was just the next town over. And the story is unique, but it's also not. So supposedly there was a veteran just after World War One, left overseas. You know, he had a girlfriend. He left in the service, came back after the war, rode his motorcycle over to her house to visit her. She didn't know he was back yet. And when he gets there, he realizes she married somebody while he was away at war. And so he tears off on his motorcycle. I either think inclement weather or driving rage, but he slips and crashes into a bridge near Elmore, Ohio, and is decapitated and becomes the Headless Rider. And now, supposedly, on the anniversary of his death, which is March 21st, you can go and perform a ritual of honking your lights 3 times with your car, honking your horn and flashing your lights. And you can make the light of his, the headlamp of his motorcycle appear and go down the road. This story in and of itself isn't that unique. There's another headless motorcyclist down in Oxford, Ohio, which is kind of down by Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. There's one in Ontario, Canada. There's one in Washington State. There's even one in Japan, apparently. So the story is kind of an archetype that moves place to place. And usually it involves like an old veteran or something like that. What was interesting, though, because I grew up learning the story that I just told you, because it was in the Haunted Ohio book. But if you go back to newspapers in the 70s and read, because they would do a Halloween special talking about the local ghost stories, they include the Headless Motorcyclist, but the story is completely different. There is no World War One veteran. It's something about an angry farmer who didn't like that his daughter was dating a guy with a motorcycle. So he strung some wire across the road. And
okay.
So it's interesting how the story evolved, right?
Yeah.
But the one thing that is unique about our story is a guy who says he saw it. He was a student at BGSU, Bowling Green State University, studying English and folklore. And him and a friend went out to the supposed bridge to investigate this, perform the ritual in 1968. And they did it 4 times, made the thing appear multiple times. In one of their experiments with it, the guy's name was Richard Gill. He sat in the car and his friend went up on the bridge and they performed the ritual and the light showed up and his buddy never came back to the car and he had to go find him. And he claimed that something struck him and he got tossed into the creek. His arm was all gashed up. His head was banged up. So something with physical force hit him. But his story, or that addition to our story, is kind of unique with the Elmore Rider, with the Headless Motorcyclist of Ohio. And I think the reason it's unique and it's been attached to the legend is it's this invitation to participate, right? If you don't believe in the Headless Motorcyclist, well, on March 21st, you can go check it out for yourself. And people do. You know, we've encountered people in our talks who say, oh, yeah, I did that when I was a kid. Nothing happened. And other people will say in the same room, well, I did it, and yeah, the light appeared, and it freaked us out, and we went home. So, you know, maybe there's something to that, maybe not, but it's this cool, I think that's what keeps it alive, is this invitation to participate.
So when are you two going?
I'm telling you, we need the live TikTok
on March 21st. Watch our Facebook page, at Unnatural Ohio. We should do it. Yeah.
But you mentioned you have headless horseman stories over in the UK. I think it's not really that big of a leap to say that those headless horseman stories kind of migrated here with the immigrants that came to the United States and then grew up from there. You know, if you read The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving, there's a lot of similarities. The Headless Horseman is a veteran of the American Revolution. He's a Hessian soldier. He lost his head in combat. And in the ending scene, he chases Ichabod Crane across a bridge, right? So you have this kind of these same elements that kind of echo. So I don't think it's that far of a leap to say that it's kind of the same story. It just kind of moves a little bit and gets an upgrade because we don't have horses.
It's horsepower now. For you then, Christina, with your experience in investigative journalists, were you tempted to kind of try and dig in? Because as Kevin says there, the story that's reported is not the story that he knows. So is it one of those that you can try and drill down into it to see when this changes?
Yeah. So Kevin actually wrote that chapter. And some of the things that I find interesting that he found are years ago in the newspapers, the story that got told is completely different than what's told today. The guys from the university who actually went out and tried to do this and experienced this, I think that's become just a huge part of the story. I mean, everyone talks about that when the story is told. But I think another thing that's interesting, and what we really try to do with the book, is if you look at the story itself that's told today about the World War One veteran, was there actually a World War One veteran who died? You would think there would be an obituary in the newspaper or a story. So Kevin went and looked and found nothing. Mm-hmm. So that was something that we really tried to do in the book. You know, did this really happen? Is there any sort of historical documentation of a World War One veteran getting in a motorcycle accident? No, there's no obituary that indicates that. So that's something we really tried to look at, even with you talk about melon heads and the evil Dr. Crow. Kevin actually looked to see, well, where does Dr. Crow come from? And he found a Dr. Crow. Now, we're certainly not saying that Dr. Crow, who actually existed, was evil and did experiments on people, but it is interesting to see, well, maybe that's part of where this name came from. Or another example is with the South Bay Bessie, who is the Lake Erie sea monster. I mean, could there really be a sea monster in Lake Erie? The answer is probably not. It's most likely a sturgeon, which is a giant fish, or a log, but it's possible, but highly unlikely.
Well, and you've observed that with the South Bay Bessie reports, is that what it looks like changes over time.
Yes, yeah. And that's one of the really interesting things about all of this, and what we tried to show in the exhibit too, is just there's a lot of folklore to these stories, and how the stories are told, how people view them changes over time. So I think those are all things we tried to dig into. But yeah, I think at the heart of it, we were really trying to see, I mean, I don't think there's any way of really proving, does Bigfoot exist or not exist? You know, there are people who always believe and people who will never believe and think everything's a hoax. But I think we tried really hard to drill down as much as we could into what is factual and what's out there. And then the reader can decide what they think.
So how's the response been to the book? It seems to be very popular. You seem to be embracing your additional careers as paranormal chroniclers. How's it been? How's life been in this field now for you both?
You know, I think the reception has been really good. We've done a number of library book talks and things like that in Northwest Ohio, and then the Frogman Festival. But people who've read it have come up to us and said, you know, I really like this book, and I really like that it's one thing to share a campfire story book, which is fun because you're retelling the tale, and the tale is a lot of fun. But it was really interesting to see kind of a serious dive into where the story comes from. They say, you know, I haven't really seen something researched in that way before with this topic.
Yeah, I would agree. That's been really exciting. I mean, you always have people who are into the stories, and we really appreciate that. But it's been nice to see that people liked the approach that we took to it, and because there are a couple places in the book, I mean, spoiler alert, where we say, yeah, this story isn't true, or this most likely was not this, or we don't say that, but well, we have primary sources that do, or we interview people who say, yeah, most likely this is not actually real. And sometimes you don't know, are people going to like that or not? So it's been nice that people seem to appreciate what we were doing with the book. So.
And then we've even had a couple people of our more history-oriented people who don't believe in stuff like this, who would typically just write off stuff like this. They would read it and said, okay, that was actually kind of interesting.
So that's been great too, because there are some people who are like, oh, this is a bunch of nonsense, but still say they really liked the book. So that's been really gratifying, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, you should be both very proud. It's a brilliant book. Like I say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And like you say, it's my kind of book, because it's not just telling stories that you could find in other books. You've got this investigative angle to it. You've got these historical research documents behind it. You've interviewed primary witnesses. You've got expert opinions from other people in specific fields. You've created a really good book. And the only thing I would say is I really hope this isn't the last thing you two do, because it's a brilliant piece of work. And I hope you both collaborate on another project of a similar vein.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you. Well, yeah, we'll keep that in mind. There are some other stories that, you know, didn't quite make the cut.
Yeah.
You know, our editor was like, you guys are over word count. No more.
Thankfully, we didn't have to cut any. Well, we did have to say, oh, we have to cut. But when we were adding up, they gave us a word count. And we're like, okay, can we fit these other things in? And then we're like, oh no, we're already over. So thankfully he was like, okay, just you're fine, but be done. That's it. So yeah, we do get asked a lot if we're going to do a sequel. So maybe. We'll see.
Well, that's always a good problem to have. I think if people hadn't asked, then that would be even worse.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So guys, where can everybody get a hold of a copy of the book, and what else, how can they keep up to date with everything that's going on in the museum going forwards?
Yeah, so you can get a copy of the book. We're located at major retailers, so overseas, probably Amazon, Barnes & Noble. We actually do sell it on our website here at the museum. It's rbhaze.org, and that's also how you can keep up to date with all of our latest exhibits. We have tons of events. I know you guys are overseas, but we actually do have virtual events that you can join. We record some of them, so we've got a couple interesting events coming up that are going to be recorded. And you can learn more about the book at our Facebook page. It's at Unnatural Ohio. So we have pictures from Frogman and some video from Frogman up there. We're always posting something. So those are some of the main ways to get it. You can also order directly through our publisher. It's the History Press, which is owned by Arcadia. So definitely able to get it online.
Yep. And maybe your local bookshop might be able to get it as well.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Support your local indie bookshop.
Yes.
Well, brilliant. I'll put links to everything in the show notes so everybody can track you down, look at the museum, and hopefully keep up to date and pop by and say hello and talk about frog creatures with you both at some points, as well as a bit of history in regards to Mr. Hayes. And I just want to thank you both for taking the time out of your day to speak to me. It's been a real pleasure. And like I say, the book was thoroughly fantastic and a really insightful read into some of the legends that Ohio has to offer. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Paul.